Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Four-star General Anthony Zinni believes a failure of leadership links the rush to war in Iraq, the disastrous government response to Hurricane Katrina, and the current economic crisis. In a new book, the former Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Central Command, drawing on lessons he learned during his time in the military, has created a guide for those who want to become leaders. The book is titled Leading the Charge, and General Zinni joins me in the studio. You can join us as well with your own questions and comments. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, General. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for having me.
I want to read for our listeners what you've written in the prologue to the book. The last paragraph, you say, this book is about the effects on leadership generated by the changes of the past two decades. It's about the leadership that's failed during those years and about the leadership that is working. First, tell us about the leadership that's failed.
Well, I think in the last two decades, beginning with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we saw remarkable changes take place globally. Mass migrations of people, effects on the environment, rising strange threats that we weren't used to or prepared for, globalization. And in the book, many other things that I described that sort of became a confluence of events to radically change the world. And I think the primary problem we have with leadership is we didn't get it. You know, we believed once the Soviet Union and communism, in effect, collapsed that, you know, the world would sort of self-right itself. And we talked about new world orders and we talked about peace dividends, and it never materialized. So I think the beginnings of failure was not assessing what kind of world was evolving that was coming about. And that led to all sorts of failure that you've alluded to in government, in business, in all aspects of society. And I saw that reflected in polls and surveys taken in that time, which increasingly showed that people felt there was a leadership crisis. Matter of fact, I mentioned one poll in the book, 2008, 77% of the American people felt we were in a leadership crisis. And across the board, there was no element of society that leaders stood out.
What's happened to the education of leaders? It would seem that in the past, leaders have emerged through the ranks, not just in the military, but as you say, in every aspect of society. And along the way, they brought with them the ethics, the outlook, the responsibility, the sense of honesty. What's happened?
Well, I think a couple of things have happened. One, and as you mentioned, the sense of integrity, having a code of conduct, of business ethics, of behavior, it slipped away. We could blame it on a lot of factors, maybe a society that changed, that became more open, the importance placed on material gain and success, the competition being much more stringent and difficult. I also think many of the leaders failed to understand some of the changes that were brought about. For example, information technology, the way we train leaders to make decisions, if you use the old processes, you're going to be left behind today because there's so much information. Communication moves so quickly. Just to give you a military example, you know, you can see in your living room the battlefield up close and personal now. And you could see it in the Pentagon war room or in the White House Situation Room. Now, we have a structure of military commands and chains of commands that go way down, and now you're dealing from the squad leader directly up to the strategic decision maker. And not understanding the impact of things like that have been part of the problem, too. So I think it's been that combination of some values being lost or put aside that are important to recover, and also conditions of not understanding what has changed, technology being one of the drivers.
We had an election in 2008, which brought us a new president. What do you think of President Obama's leadership thus far?
Well, I think there are certain areas that obviously kept him in good stead. He is obviously a great communicator. He has a sense of touch and a charisma and a personal way of engaging that I think is something the American people want to see. They want to have that confidence in their president. They want to see that president up close and personal. And I think that's very valuable to him. He's eloquent. He seems committed and sincere and interested in what has to be done. Obviously, we're only in the past 6 months, and it's hard to tell if some of the decisions he's made will be the right ones on the economy, on health care, on obviously the crises that face us overseas. He's done some interesting things when you look at decision-making and organizational structure that I think are a bit controversial. For example, we have this team of rivals, and we have this sort of superstructure, these super envoys that are out there. And there's been some question about whether that will work. So there we have an example of where he's done something organizationally very different. And whether that's going to be positive or negative, we'll see. And you're beginning to see two schools of thought on things like that. So I think in a personal sense, to kind of sum it up, he has the right attributes. He reminds you of a Ronald Reagan or a Jack Kennedy in that kind of touch. But in the end, we're going to judge our leaders, particularly our presidents, on whether they're successful or not.
General Zinni, you almost went to work for the Obama administration. I'd like to hear from you personally
right. What
happened.
Well, I was called right before the inauguration and asked if I would be willing to serve serve in the administration and a couple of possibilities. And then by General Jones, the National Security Advisor. And I said I would, given the positions he mentioned. And then right after the inauguration, he called and asked if I would serve as the ambassador to Iraq. And I said I would. And received a call from the vice president thanking me that I would
vice
take that
president
on.
Biden.
Vice President Biden. And I met with Secretary of State Clinton and her deputy, two deputies, spent a long time with her in the office. She was asking me about what I understood about Iraq, my assessment. I had just gotten back not long before that, doing an assessment out there. And then I left that meeting, understanding fully that, I was going to be the nominee. I mean, I was told to prepare for it. We would move the process forward very quickly because of the outgoing Ambassador Ryan Crocker was coming out very quickly.
You shook hands on it.
Yes, we did. I mean, there was no way I left and didn't think this was going to happen. And actually thought I had a very short period of time to get my affairs in order. I mean, obviously, there are a number of things you have to do in your own financial family and all that sort of thing. And for a week went by, and I was told, to stay in touch, be prepared, move the paperwork forward. We're going to move up the confirmation hearings. And nothing was happening. And I tried to contact people. I couldn't get any answers. And finally, about a week later, I finally got a hold of General Jones, and he informed me I was not the choice. And I was kind of surprised and shocked by it. And then the next morning in the Washington Post, I read that it's Chris Hill. And I thought, had I not gotten a hold of General Jones, that's how I would have found out. And to be honest with you, I can understand people changing their minds, and I don't object to that. That's a fact of life. I was just put back by not being called or told by anyone, and to this date, I haven't had anybody explain to me what happened. So, but I moved on. I mean, clearly, you have to understand Washington, the way things work, and I've moved on from there.
What's your best guess as to why you were not chosen?
Honestly, Diane, I don't know. One of the reasons, I started getting calls that very day from the media, from the press, and people saying, these are the rumors we're hearing. And they were attributed to senior government officials, so that was disturbing. And many of the reasons given, I clearly knew were not right. Because,
such as,
the Pentagon didn't want you, or a certain general didn't want you, all of whom I knew it personally, and it's just the opposite. As a matter of fact, were calling me upset that it hadn't gone through. So I began to be bothered by some of the rumors that obviously were coming out of, supposedly attributed by the media to senior government officials.
What kinds of rumors?
Well, it was this particular lobby that worked against you. It was this particular individual that stopped it, or this person. And to me, many of them I knew weren't true. Many of them I thought were only based on rumor. And so I thought it important, since they were asking me what happened, I tried to not engage them. But then I finally said, well, look, let me just tell you the course of events that went by. So there's no misunderstanding that, I didn't know or understand that I was to be the nominee. And what happened? And to this date, nobody's told me what happened. Not that I'm interested anymore, but I haven't been told.
So even speaking with General Jones, he did not give you a reason.
He did not. Our last conversation right after that was, well, I'll get back to you as I find out. And that was in January, then I have not heard anything about it. Not that I'm not interested anymore.
Of course, you're not interested anymore, since it's over and done with. On the other hand, as a human being, if I had been in your position, I would have felt really stung.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, I guess the best way to describe my feeling was I was disappointed, because there were many friends and people that I respected tremendously in this process. And so that created a disappointment and confusion on my part as to exactly what happened.
Confusion. Really typical of Washington. General Tony Zinni is with me. His new book is titled Leading the Charge: Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. General Anthony Zinni is with me, and he is one of the New York Times best-selling authors. His new book is titled Leading the Charge: Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. We are going to open the phone shortly and take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. General Zinni, there is talk that the administration may declare victory and leave Iraq sooner than planned. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, in terms of combat troops, I think the schedule we're on is the right one. We've done about all we can do in terms of our troops, coalition troops, patrolling the streets and in the cities. We have worked hard enough and long enough with the Iraqi security forces that they have the capability to stand up to the challenge. Now, they will have problems. They're not perfect. I do think as we go forward, we'll have to continue security assistance programs, helping them with the right equipment, training, education of their leaders and officers. And that's not just military. That's police and other security elements that they have there. But I think that's on track, and I think an ongoing program of that kind of support is necessary to maintain. It's now up to the Iraqi government. I mean, I think we have put them in a position to succeed. It's going to be an issue of their capability and competence to administer, to allocate funds, to build programs. I spent some time over there late last year at the request of Ambassador Crocker and General Odierno, a part of an assessment team looking around. And I came away, especially when I was with some of the ministers and the ministries in the Iraqi government, you know, realizing they're learning something that they have no experience in, and that's how to govern, how to build a bureaucracy, how to make policy. They have some inherent, you know, friction points. Obviously, it isn't like there's one party in office, and so you can be consistent. They have a Sunni, a Kurd, a Shia, and you have differences that they have to come to grips with internally. They're beginning to learn the how bureaucracies function and how governments need to do the nitty-gritty of getting things done. And in walking some of the streets and talking to some of the people, trying to assess what their expectations are, it came out clear to me that it will succeed if they feel their government is responsive to their needs. Mm. They want security. Mm. They want their essential services met. They want that electricity on 24/7, their garbage picked up.
But suppose all that breaks down. Then what happens to the U.S. and its military?
Well, I feel, you know, of course, I oppose going into Iraq when we did, wrong war, wrong place, wrong time. And, you know, that's people have come down on different sides of that. But the reason I did is we could not afford a destabilized, disconnected Iraq, especially since we had other requirements around the world, particularly Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. A fragmented, destabilized Iraq right in the heart of the Middle East, I don't think will be, for the international community, will be able to cope with that or deal with that by ignoring it. That was my concern. Once you're in all the way. And I don't think you're going to see a total collapse, but I do think my worry would be, and I don't think this will happen, but you could see a fragmentation and see a Kurdish area, Sunni area, Shia area split up. And, you know, and the violence that may go with that, because at the points where they meet and the fault lines, of course, there's great danger. That is going to be difficult for the region. And that's going to wash over and create more problems that we have. And I would hate to say this, but I think we're going to be in a position where we can't let that happen, and we need to redefine that we now is not only the United States, and we need to build more support for ensuring it doesn't happen to begin with, or be prepared to take the right actions to react to it.
But isn't there very little support internationally?
There is very little support internationally. As a matter of fact, one of my worries about Afghanistan, we're beginning to see waning support, and I know you want to talk about that, but Iraq, of course, because the initial entry into Iraq was not received favorably, you know, in the international community with some exceptions, and so the stomach for re-engagement obviously isn't there. But I want to say I left there, and I went there as a skeptic, of course, and but I admired what General Petraeus did, what Ryan Crocker did, General Odierno, because I think they turned it around and gave it a chance. I would say right now, I do think it will have bumps along the road, but it can succeed. And I would give you some things to watch. There are three elections in this year. We've already had one. It went very well. If the other two go well, and what I mean by well, the people come out to vote, it's secure, there's no fraud or excess influence, it shouldn't be inappropriate influence, those are going to be good signs. If you begin to see those essential services, they're being met, you see the electricity going up, I think then it's going to be on its way to reasonable stability, at least in the near term, and maybe in the long term, even more sustainable stability.
And what about Afghanistan? What kind of an outlook do you see there?
It's going to be a long haul. I think the next 3 to 5 years are going to be very difficult. I think the administration's strategy is the right one, although it's very, very ambitious. The president has said that, first of all, we can't lose focus as we did before. Al-Qaeda is what we're after. That's the main objective. In addition, of course, we're dealing with the Taliban and the problems that they present. He's also said that we have to regionalize this problem. In other words, we have to get the Afghans, the Pakistanis, the Indians to cooperate. That's extremely difficult. We've appointed a super envoy out there. I would assume that's Ambassador Holbrooke's job, is to get them together, make them work together. They each acknowledge, and I've been out there recently in Pakistan talking to all the senior leadership, they point to each other as the cause of the problem. And underlying that is the solution is cooperation. Difficult to achieve, but necessary. Thirdly, and the president's been adamant on this point, we need international support for this. I think NATO's been woefully absent, with the exception of the Brits, Canadians, Dutch, now the French. You know, for the 20-some nations in NATO, the lack of forces on the ground, the lack of contribution and support and development, I think should be an issue on the question of redefining NATO.
And the president has said he would reassess at the end of a year. I don't know whether that meant this year or a year from whenever. Yeah.
Well, I think there you always reassess. I think you have to constantly be checking on the indicators of the progress. One measure, obviously, is Afghan security forces, Pakistani military operations. Those are all going to require our involvement. It's a train, organize, equip. Obviously, for the Afghan side, you know, my guess and my estimate from my military experience, it will take you a minimum of 3 years to build anywhere near the kinds of security forces and police.
And do you believe that the American people are going to support that kind of involvement for that length of time, seeing their husbands, their brothers, their sons come home?
I think it's important for the president to ensure that we understand what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Why are we doing it?
Well, we're doing
General
it because, fundamentally because the people who attacked us on 9/11 are still there, still viable, still planning our demise. That kind of sanctuary in that part of the world still is threatening. In addition to that, we have two nuclear powers out there. One, you know, very wobbly in terms of Pakistan. You can sort of conjure up all the bad things that can happen if we have a destabilized and fragmented Pakistan or a collapsed Pakistan. I think the problems inside Afghanistan, the rise of extremism, could move throughout the region, Central Asia and elsewhere. So I think there are all sorts of strategic reasons. It's not pleasant. My son's a Marine officer. He has served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's going back. And, you know, none of us like to see that happen. But I have to say, in this situation, our security is at risk if this isn't stabilized in some way.
I want to read a paragraph from your prior book, mm-hmm. Battle Ready. You said, in the lead up to the Iraq War and its later conduct, I saw, at a minimum, true dereliction, negligence, and irresponsibility, at worst, lying, incompetence, and corruption. You go on to say, I continue to be amazed at the silence and passivity of our military leadership, with few exceptions, during the run-up to the Iraq invasion in 2003, when Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney decreed that the invasion would be a walkover and the occupation would be a piece of cake, only one senior military leader publicly objected, Army Chief of Staff Eric Shinseki. He was ostracized and driven into retirement. We've had over 4,000 deaths
right.
since that happened. Do you see a change in the thinking on the part of the military?
Absolutely. I think there's a wonderful new generation of leaders, people like General Dave Petraeus, Ray Odierno, Jim Mattis, a Marine four-star general command.
Who are willing to speak up.
They're willing to speak up. They learned on the ground. They have spent multiple tours in there. The young officers coming up that were battalion and brigade commanders and saw the effects on the ground of poor planning, insufficient troops, pie in the sky objectives were handed to them. I mean, we forged another generation that reminds me of our Vietnam generation that came out. And these lessons learned, I think going forward, we'll see the military more vocal. I mean, this isn't to say they're not going to have the same kind of discipline and subordination to civilian authority. But more importantly, I think it's not just the military that had to change and learn, and they did. I think it's also our civilian leadership. I think you're going to see our leaders seek much more counsel and maybe to hear contrarian views. You know, I was proud that I worked for Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen, who told us very clearly, us commanders, four stars, that if we objected to something, we had to give it to him, and he would ensure the president heard it. And on a couple of occasions when I objected to administration policy or a course of action, and even though he disagreed with me, he took me to see the president, the leadership in Congress, to ensure my voice was heard. And I think that's about the healthiest thing we can have in this government.
Now, just think back to our going into Iraq and the people who were out there protesting, the individual citizens around the country who were saying, this war is not necessary. There are lies being told to the American people. They were deemed traitors. They were called unpatriotic. They were ostracized. They were deemed people who had no idea of what was going on. That kind of attitude on the part of leaders, General Zinni, is pretty scary in our democracy.
Well, our democracy was created by an exceptional group of men more than two centuries ago who understood the dangers of too much power in any branch of government or with any individual. And everything they did in our constitutional structure, and we've done since, was to ensure that that power wasn't placed in one place where it could be abused, because power does abuse, does become a source of abuse. And I think what we have learned from that now is to try to put in more of the checks and balances and more of the demand for wide voices being heard. I think our Congress learned from this. And maybe that's the most important institution. I mean, beside our executive branch and the presidency, but the Congress learned that they can't step back and not question. I got called to Congress a number of times during that because I was the, you know, maybe the one voice or one of several voices that were objecting to this. And we were called those same names that you did. And our reason was just pure common sense and military understanding of what was going to happen and experience in the region. And I saw quite a few congressmen from both sides of the aisle that had doubts about this, about doubts about the intelligence, doubts about the wisdom of the action, doubts about assessments about how easy it might be, doubts about coming off the primary objective, which was al-Qaeda. And yet they were intimidated, maybe by the fact that the blood was up after 9/11, maybe by the fact that the cherry-picking of the intelligence made it difficult to counter it. I would hope they learned a lesson that you have to have the courage of your commitments and not worry about the next election. And you have an obligation, especially if you're the loyal opposition, to present the counterargument and to ensure it is well thought out by that discussion and that counterargument.
At 25 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tell me a little about how you learned to become a leader. There is an email here that says, how did General Zinni get the nickname the Godfather?
Well, the nickname was given to me when I was a young captain, and I was in the wardroom of a ship. Our unit was deployed to the Caribbean. This is in the early 70s, and kind of a grizzled old Navy chaplain, whose name was Johnny Walker, by the way, came through the wardroom and saw me talking to my lieutenants and schooling my lieutenants as a young captain.
And what does talking to or schooling mean?
Well, it means, you know, maybe correcting some of the things that they could do better and, you know, that sort of thing. But in a way, they were young officers to educate them. Of course, I'd been through that. So it was in a godfatherly way. And so he stopped and smiled as he got his cup of coffee, and he looked it over and he said, "The Godfather." Well, of course, my lieutenants immediately grabbed it, and that stuck with me for the rest of my career.
And our emailer goes on to say, "How would the wars for Afghanistan and Iraq be different if you, General Zinni, had run things?"
Well, I would have counseled not doing Iraq. I mean, it was not, we had to take care of business with Al-Qaeda first. If you want to engage in Iraq, that should come later. If you decided on military action in Iraq, my conclusion after 10 years in that theater and as ultimately the commander of CENTCOM and providing the last war plan, you had to do it with a significant number of troops, much like General Shinseki said, in order to do it. And you had to understand it would not be a cakewalk. There will not be flowers in the street. You have to seal the borders. You have to control the people. You can't do things that further destabilize, like de-Ba'athification to the point where you alienate a segment of society. You should not disband the military. We spent a number of years communicating to the Iraqi regular military that we would not. Keep people at work. Don't disband government-owned factories just because they're state-owned and put people out of work. We knew this well before.
General Tony Zinni, his new book is titled Leading the Charge. When we come back, we'll open the phones. I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Island Press and the Tides Foundation. Island Press provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Paul Giamatti. He played a lovesick wine snob in Sideways, the cantankerous underground cartoonist Harvey Pekar in American Splendor, and a founding father in the HBO series John Adams. Now he's playing an actor who has his soul extracted in the new film Cold Souls. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And here's our first email for General Tony Zinni. He's the author of a brand new book titled Leading the Charge. Ron identifies himself as retired U.S. military. He says, "I'd like to know whether General Zinni feels, in my view, improper influence by and encouragement of Christian evangelicals and furthering theistic agendas at our service academies and installations has negatively affected our military's critical thinking abilities and the ability to forge international coalitions."
Well, I think, certainly of late, the issue of very public involvement in particular religious beliefs has been an issue, not only in the military but elsewhere. Obviously, we have a strong tradition of providing for the ability to embrace one's faith in the military. That's why we have a chaplain corps, and I've seen it proven on the battlefield and elsewhere, and it's necessary. I think, though, we have to keep it in the right perspective. Religion is a private matter. We are a very diverse society, and that's rich and important to us. We have an even more diverse military and society now, and there are a vast variety of faiths and religious beliefs. We have to provide the ability for everybody to pursue their beliefs in their own way, and we should not be in a position, because this is contrary to our very Constitution, to try to enforce one religious belief system or make it paramount over others. And I think that would be the wrong thing in the military and would even have even be a strong constitutional issue.
We have an email from Mary. General Zinni, please comment on Blackwater's role in the Iraq War and what that says about military leadership.
Right. I think the whole business of contracting came upon, and I had been involved with companies that did contracting too. The whole business of contracting, I think, is in desperate need of review. It came on us very quickly. As we began to draw down and go to an all-volunteer force, we saw the efficiencies and benefits of outsourcing certain requirements and capabilities. Some made sense, some were questionable, but there was a rush to do it. We've learned now from a number of decades of experience and several wars. I think it would be healthy for Congress to look at what should be contracted and what should not. There are certain areas that I think, even if they're more effective, more efficient, more cost-effective, like personal security, maybe that's something we should not do as a nation, and we should have that capability in uniform under better accountability and control. There may be other areas like maintenance and other things that make all the sense in the world because you have high level of skills. You can contract for those kinds of capabilities from manufacturers that made the equipment. You have retired military that have extensive experience that could be working on it. And it might be beneficial to the taxpayer and to the military and what they receive in not only the quality support, but the quality in terms of cost effectiveness. So I don't think the concept of contracting and outsourcing is wrong. In many places, it makes ultimate sense. But I don't think we've done the review that we should do now. And I would add one other thing. What also is missing, and I think that's part of the question that was asked, is monitoring these contracts and contractors. We need a better system. We have in the Department of Defense, they're used to this kind of contracting, and it's much better. But in many cases, some of our other government agencies, like State Department and others, got caught up with a massive requirement for contracting that they weren't used to and didn't have the full capability. And were playing catch-up and doing an admirable job in what they were trying to do. We maybe need to rethink about government contracting, monitoring, and accountability out there.
Didn't it come down to the fact that there weren't enough of troops to go into places that the U.S. wanted them to go?
Well, you know, I've seen this from both sides, and you have to ask yourself, should I create an organization in the military that does something that I don't need all the time? For example, we're going to feed troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, we're also still feeding troops at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, or Fort Bragg. So when I surge for these requirements, isn't it better to contract it for this temporary requirement? Doesn't it make more sense than me recruiting soldiers, having this huge benefit system?
But isn't it more expensive to hire contractors?
No. If you look at what you're doing, the cost of recruiting, the cost of a career path, the cost of education of that individual, the schools you send them to, the benefits you pay, the family support and systems that you're paying. This is all, you know, the contracting could be much more cost effective. We make the mistake when we say, well, let me take the salary of a private and compare it to a salary of a contractor does the same thing. But you forget about all those other costs that come with that that are very expensive. Manpower is the most expensive portion of the Department of Defense budget. And most people believe it's, you know, high-end, expensive, highly technical systems, but it's not. And so manpower in uniform becomes much more expensive than it is in terms of contracting in some cases.
So you would not ever see returning to a draft.
No. I know there's been a lot of argument. I have a lot of military friends that feel strongly about it because it's good for the country and young people. We have an all-volunteer force, highly professionalized. Mixing a draft into this force is not only unnecessary, I think it would be counterproductive.
All right. Let's go now to Randy in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Given the history of the relationship between the people of Iraq and the government of the United States over the last few decades, isn't it inevitable that the government which will emerge in Baghdad will be anti-American? And don't we have to accept that inevitability in order to extract ourselves?
Thank you, Randy. Well, I don't think it will be anti-American. I don't think it will be pro-American either. I think it will want a cooperative relationship with us. Let me give you an example. They are now building their military. From my talks with the Ministry of Defense there and others, they want to model it on our military. They want our military equipment. They want an organization, a structure like ours. We're going to have a U.S. military assistance program, people that advise, help train them. They are now being educated in our school system. But I don't think, you know, to kind of follow your point, if we think they're going to become so pro-American in our camp, they live in a region of the world where they have many neighbors, and they're going to have a sense that I have to have good relationships with all.
Here's an email from Robert who says, a question regarding leadership. The leader should respect and defend his troops and lead by example with this in mind. We have both government and business leaders who line their pockets through PACs or bonuses while laying off people. How can this be responsible leadership?
Well, I think he reflects the anger that we see now at these tremendous compensation packages where we reward lack of performance and incompetence. And I think there's going to be a demand, maybe even legislation, that changes much of this. I can tell you that in the company I'm with and the companies I've been with, your bonuses or your compensation are based on two things, your personal performance and then the performance of the organization overall. I mean, you can't be, as Robert points out, you can't be receiving all this sort of extraordinary compensation at the top while the organization is not doing well and the people at the bottom are suffering. And I think it's going to require a major change of attitude and maybe even regulation and legislation to enforce it.
To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Diana. Good morning, General.
Good morning.
Yeah, I want to get back to more the fundamental aspect of this ethic thing. Our principal ethic in society is based on our economic relationship with one another. And it's, you know, I always argue that companies that do bad ethically are sort of entrapped by the comparability of other companies doing unethical things. And that, the basis of that is excess money, money that's not real, money that's not really at risk. And so what we have today is a consequence of 20 to 30 years of the Federal Reserve accommodating business. And therein is the breakdown in the ethic, because no one ultimately becomes responsible as much as they should be to the risk, and they end up doing essentially unethical things. And there's just too many formulas for playing the game that shouldn't exist if we didn't do this. So we're all part of this. We all knew the values of our houses were not, we didn't do things that really increased the value, and yet we sort of winked and nodded at this process, failing to see that what we're doing is what we've ended up with now, is we're all in this mess, and it's the ethics of that process. It's the ethic of, or the breakdown in ethic of honest money that really is the source of all these things.
I think that's a tremendous point, and I think you just described the reason for the economic situation we're in. I had talked to friends that were bankers, and I said to them, how could you have gotten into this subprime mess, knowing that that some of this lending was high risk, and then valuing it as an asset, much like we do prime lending? And the answer I got exactly fit your description. Well, everybody else was doing it, and they were making money on it. So you can't be left behind. And so I think when you begin to compromise what you believe in, what you know is right, you take extraordinary risk, you go along with the crowd, or you go along with the industry you're in and what they're doing that doesn't make sense, you're going to have this bubble burst in terrible ways. And, of course, as you point out, Michael, the impact is on those poor homeowners and those that were lured into or led to believe they could afford things that were way beyond their means.
I remember when my children were very young, they'd come home and say, "Well, Mom, everybody else is doing
exactly.
it." And I'd say, "Tough.
Yes, exactly.
We are not." Here we go. Here is an email from Jeff, who says, "Does your guest really believe that if we defeat the terrorists in that region, that the U.S. will be safe? What will prevent them from going somewhere else?"
Well, that's exactly what they're trying to do. As the pressure is put on them in a place like Afghanistan, we saw them slip across the border into Pakistan. I believe now, if you look at al-Qaeda, you see them beginning to look at the potential for bases and beginning to get involved in places like Somalia, Yemen, and other areas. They're going to constantly seek places where the rule of law doesn't exist and the ability of security forces to counter what they do doesn't exist. And, you know, we are in this situation where you've got to chase them down, or you have to look for these potential places that don't have the stability and work with, this is my point, with the international community to build that stability. And we could point out the parts of the world they will run to or flee to or attempt to establish their sanctuaries, and it will be a case that that happens. They're not bound by borders. They are not organized in that way.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How do you intend to get these lessons from the battlefield into the boardroom, into political thinking, into classrooms, everywhere?
Well, I think, again, this is a function of leadership. I would hope, and I do see, because I have a number of academic chairs I've held, I've seen our universities now, our business schools and leadership centers on university campuses begin to stress and emphasize ethical behavior, team building, care for the people that work for you, the ability to think strategically, to have a vision, to make decisions in the right way, to process information the right way. I mean, correct all the mistakes that have led us to this sort of position where we've had these leadership failures. And I've seen it now. It's in its embryonic stages, but in business, too. We invest a lot, for example, in the company I'm with, on our own leader development, a tremendous investment in our code of conduct, our ethical training, and enforcement of that training in what we do. And so I would say very carefully, there is the beginnings of change. Unfortunately, it had to come about because of the mistakes were made, and in some cases because regulatory agencies and congressional action forced some of this. But now it's just become good business because primarily the people demand it, and I think that's the key.
Are you going to take this message across the country?
Yes, and matter of fact, that's why I wrote the book. I felt strongly enough about it. I don't pretend to be the expert on leadership. I mean, I've gone on almost half a century of leadership experience, and some of that's been through mistakes that I think all of us leaders should be honest and open about. We should learn from our own mistakes. I do think it's critically important that senior leaders that want to see change become more vocal. Sometimes it's risky. People don't agree with you. People criticize you. They may not like the message you have, but I see a growing number of people in my position, especially at my stage of life now, that feel this is what we have to convey to our youth.
Joseph sends an email saying, "Tell the general to run for president." Do you have any political thoughts?
No.
None?
None. And in the past, since I retired, I was offered the possibility of running for office in several places, and but I'm not interested in political office. Sometimes I think if you have something to say or something to do or a message to get across, as soon as you assume a political position or a political party, everybody suspects what you're doing, you know, that is driven by some political ambition or motivation or point of view. I like to think of myself as apolitical, you know, and I think you can be more effective if you retain that position.
Do you have family?
Oh, I do. I have three children, seven grandchildren, son in the Marine Corps, and wonderful wife of 42 years.
So. Where is your son now?
He is at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He has served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Will probably go back, I'm sure, and serve many other places, too, beside that.
Would you like to see our troops come home from Iraq in a short time?
I think the schedule we're on is the right one. I, of course, like every father and every brother, I would parent, I would like to see the troops home as soon as possible. But I would like that time determined by people like General Odierno, General Petraeus, Admiral Mullen, Secretary Gates, because I have ultimate faith in them.
General Anthony Zinni. His new book is titled Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Thank you for your service, General Zinni.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for being here. Thanks to all of you for listening. Have a great day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.